Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. This hour, we'll be talking about life-threatening food allergies that affect over 17 million Americans, many of whom are children too young to fully appreciate the potentially deadly consequences of an exposure. There are currently very few treatment options for food allergy patients, other than avoiding known triggers and carrying injectable EpiPens. But that all may be about to change thanks to recent groundbreaking allergy research being conducted right here in the Bay Area. Joining me on the phone and in studio to discuss this pressing issue, we have three terrific guests. On the phone, we have Dr. Kari Nadeau, Associate Professor of Allergies and Immunology at Stanford University School of Medicine and Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. She is a graduate of Harvard Medical School, where she received a PhD in biochemistry and immunology. And she is the director of the brand new Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy Research at Stanford, funded by a recent $24 million gift from the Silicon Valley entrepreneur. Kari, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
We are also very fortunate to be joined by two parents whose children have been treated by Dr. Kari Nadeau. They also are the founders of the community outreach program at the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy Research. Melissa Kepner, Kim Grasso, thank you both very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Kari Nadeau, let's start with you. It seems like allergies, particularly with children, have increased exponentially. It's really exploded into the public consciousness in recent years. But how prevalent are serious food allergies among children?
That's a great question. So we have data to show us now that in the United States, under the age of 21, one in every 12 children has a doctor's diagnosis of food allergy. And about 25% of those people will have a near-fatal anaphylaxis at some point in their lives. I think this is really important to take in because this is a disease that is not just a nuisance disease. This is a serious disease that we need to get ahead of. We need to treat and treat effectively, but we also need to try to prevent and find the cause as to why these numbers are increasing. They're doubling every 10 years.
And why do some people have these severe reactions?
That's a great question. That's exactly what we're studying. And one of the things that Sean Parker wanted to invest in is to be able to look at how we can diagnose people better, how we can make sure we understand why some people have more severe reactions and some people don't. But it really depends on time and age. And importantly, we are working on that at Stanford. We've made a lot of progress, but there's still progress to be made. And I'm very excited to be leading this effort with some fantastic scientists and, most importantly, the community to help us move this needle forward on making huge impacts in the field.
So tell us about your work at Stanford. What are you trying there that hasn't been tried before?
Sure. I was very excited when I started to be trained there in 2003 with a wonderful mentor by the name of Dale Ometsu. He and I were working together to design the correct quote-unquote recipe to make sure that if we were going to start treating people under experimental, what we call, regimens that were approved by the FDA, but still very experimental in nature, very early in testing, we wanted to see whether or not just giving the food would help someone become desensitized over time to their food allergen, but in addition, we wanted to use it in combination with another therapy that would potentially make this desensitization procedure safer. And so to make it safer, we started to use this unique combination of food therapy, where you give the same thing that someone's allergic to very slowly over time, and you very slowly desensitize their body to that food allergen. But in addition, we added this other therapy that had already been started to be used for asthma, and it's called anti-IgE or omalizumab, and Genentech makes the drug. So we used it in combination with the food, and we got very good results. In addition, we have some patients that did not receive the omalizumab. They also have good results, and we're looking at how well those are sustained in the future. But I think what the unique part about Stanford is that we gained a lot of knowledge. We used that knowledge over a course of 9 years to develop protocols to help all ages, both children and adults, for not just one single food allergy, but multiple allergies. 30% of people have more than one food allergy. And that's really important to know, that we at Stanford developed a protocol to address the needs of all ages, as well as all different types of food allergies, with and without combination therapy. So it was a matter of really working hard, being inspired by patients, and using unique protocols and moving forward. We still have a lot to learn. We still have a lot of ways to move forward. But importantly, as we have pushed the needle forward already, and we're looking forward to doing it more.
Well, and we'll be talking a lot more about that this hour. Now I would like to turn to some of your patients' parents who you've been working with for a long time. Kim, let's start with you. When did you first realize that your daughter, Tessa, had a severe food allergy?
We found out that Tessa had allergies probably first when she was 6 months old. And when she was 9 months old, she had her first trip to the hospital. And I think it's kind of realizing how severe the allergy is really evolves over time. She had her first nearly fatal reaction when she was almost two. So we knew at a very early age that she had food allergies, but we had no idea when she was first diagnosed how severely life-threatening her allergies were.
What was it like when she was 2 years old when you had that first incident?
It was brutal. I mean, there's no other way to explain. When you're holding your daughter in your arms, who's literally going limp and who's lifeless because milk spilled on her hands.
So it wasn't even something that she had eaten.
She hadn't even eaten it, actually.
Wow.
And obviously that was a definite wake-up call, because no one had any, you know, we had no idea that it could be that severe. And from that point on, I mean, we were always very careful, but we just didn't have a realization of really how severe it was.
I just can't imagine going through something like that. How quickly after that were you able to connect to Kari and her clinic?
7 years.
So that must have been a long 7 years.
Not quickly at all. Not quickly at all. But when I did meet her, it was, you know, it was like seeing an angel, really, honestly. When you go through life and you have a sick child and you truly become on this, you enter this quest and you start on this quest to find the person that's going to cure your child. And I had been all over the country to try and find the doctor who I come to find in my backyard, and I just happened to hear her speak, and it was the first time that I had ever felt hope that there might be a cure for Tessa, or that even, maybe not even a cure at the time, it was really just somebody that could help her severity so that she could possibly live a normal life.
Let's turn to you now, Melissa. How did you first learn about your daughter Kate's allergies, and how did you first get connected to Dr. Nato?
Well, similar to Kim's story, we realized that our daughter Kate had food allergies when she was 4 months old. She was actually passing blood, and investigating that problem, we realized it was food allergy. It was coming from my breast milk, because I was actually eating the things she was allergic to. So we started going down this path of food allergies and what that meant to us as a family. And, you know, we just, at that time, we're told, you know, strict avoidance of the allergens was the regimen. There was really no cure. And living that life, we realized it was so difficult to avoid her allergens, because they were so common. She had dairy, egg, either easier things to avoid were the sesame and the nuts, but dairy and egg were in everything, particularly for children. And so that just sort of changed everything we did. We didn't go to restaurants. We rarely traveled. If we did travel, we were sort of like the clampets. We had to bring all our pots and pans and everything and kind of cook in our hotel room. But we just couldn't risk having some sort of cross-contamination in a kitchen. And because it was such a life-changing event for us. And as parents, we were filled with, you know, worry and fear a bunch of the time because we realized, you know, when your child is young, you can protect them. But as they get older, you realize you have to send them to school and then out to camps and whatnot. We thought, you know, this is going to be very difficult to manage and very stressful. And we worried as our child got older that she, too, would absorb the stress and realize the ever-present danger she was in. And so my husband and I just decided, gosh, with this many people having food allergies, and it was sort of like a growing epidemic, there really had to be something out there. Someone had to be working on the problem. So very similar to Kim, we just started researching and following who was studying food allergies. And we, too, went to New York, and we even contemplated moving to North Carolina because there was a very interesting trial going on at Duke University at the time. And in this process, we realized, just like Kim, you know, an amazing study was going on at Stanford Hospital, you know, right in our backyard. And so as soon as Kate was five and was eligible for the trial, she became one of the first participants in the OIT trial.
Do either of you have allergies yourselves?
I do not, but my husband does.
And I have seasonal allergies. There's nobody else in our family that has food allergies, so this was completely new to us.
And I guess the question of whether it's genetic or not is something we might get to a little later in the program. What I'd like to go now, Kari, could you share with us exactly what is this treatment regimen? How did you come up with the idea to try something different, and what does it consist of exactly?
Yeah, it's still in experimental stages, and we need to do this in a hospital setting with trained individuals. But importantly, is this took the work of many people, and I think in all of science, it's a building block. I had great mentors. I did have a lot of collaborations with other people around the world to be able to put this together. And my colleague and I, Dale Ametsu, and I had thought long and hard about how do you use combination therapies and how do you use them effectively to help patients. So it started in the test tube. We didn't want to try anything out in humans and in children who they have the most amount of food allergies. Adults have it as well, and it can be near fatal to fatal in adults, but we wanted to try it in children first. And because of that, we had to work really hard, do our homework up front. And so we took blood cells in the dish of patients who had allergies, and then we tried combinations of different therapies over time to see what worked well to stop the cells in the dish from reacting to the food. So this was all done outside of the body using sophisticated, innovative techniques on the blood level. And what's wonderful is that we are at the day and age that we can do that now to be able to use what we call human research on human cells to help us then move forward and make rationally designed therapy. And so we took that, did a lot of homework, did the work in our laboratory, and found that this combination that was effective in the cells could also be now worked in humans. So we talked to the FDA, designed our study, and this is what it entailed. So we gave this special medicine called anti-IgE. And IgE is like the match that lights the fire behind allergies. And so if you can quench that match, you can oftentimes decrease the likelihood of reaction when you start taking the very same thing that you're allergic to. And so we said, okay, let's try that anti-IgE for the first 8 weeks. Let's give it to the person. And what that entails is you have to take a shot, and you have to take a shot pretty much every 2 weeks to every month, and you get that into your body so that it protects your body. And then at 8 weeks, then you start your food. So you have this kind of protective cover that we've given you in the form of this anti-IgE medicine. And then we start you on therapy. And we continue giving you the anti-IgE medicine. So you come in our clinic, and then we very carefully give you the food, ever so carefully in a staged approach, so that if you have any hives, we stop the dose. And then we say, okay, you can go home on the dose that's safe. And we continue giving you the medicine of the anti-IgE. So every day you're taking a small amount. It's basically specks of sand that you can see in a little dish, and we mix it with applesauce or pudding if you're not allergic to milk. And then you take that every day, and we tell you to call us if you have any reactions. Reactions occur sometimes, but it's important to know that if they do, we are trying in the process to make your body stronger. And so people take that food daily, and then they come back into our clinic every 2 weeks, and we give you the anti-IgE medicine. We increase your food dose ever so slightly. And then by about 8 months, then we start taking off that anti-IgE medicine. You don't have to come into the clinic as frequently. And then we let you go home, and you take the doses of the food every day. And you come back into clinic about every month, and we increase the dose. And at the end of about 9 to 10 months, you can then take a serving's worth of food. And people are very excited about being able to eat milk for the first time, or egg, or a Reese's peanut butter cup. So that's where we see a lot of smiles on the patients' faces. It's a lot of work. And Kim and Melissa will tell you that this is teamwork. It takes an incredibly motivated parent and child to move through this system, because it is daily dosing. It's daily ingestion of food, and it's hard work to take shots, for example, in many of the children. But they do it because at the end, they can achieve this wonderful state of being able to socialize, being able to not live in fear. And I think that's really important for us as clinicians, to be able to be inspired by patients and to have our goals be their goals. But we have to do it really scientifically. Some people do not take the Xolair. For example, in Melissa's daughter's case, Kate, she did not have the Xolair, but that's fine too. It might take a little bit longer to get to a serving's worth of food, but we see that in children that don't have the Xolair, they can get to their serving's worth of food as well.
Kim, let me ask you, what was it like? Obviously, intellectually, you understand that this is all to help your daughter, but at the same time, you're giving her the very thing that has caused these life-threatening situations. The first few times you did it, was it stressful to go through?
Oh, incredibly stressful. I mean,
you were in the hospital at the time, though, so you had people around you to help if necessary.
Yes. And it was not only stressful on us, it was also incredibly stressful on Tessa.
You know,
she started the study when she was 8, so she was very aware of what she was going in to do. And I tell the story of the first day when we were walking in, and the first day Tessa was going to start ingesting the food. And she looked up at me and she said, "Mom, if I die, this is your fault."
And my goodness.
It took absolutely, you know, that just gives you a good idea of the stress that everybody's under and the anxiety. But very quickly, Kari and her team are unbelievably comforting. And you, like Kari said, it really does take a team. And the hardest day is the first day. And when you are in there and you see how supportive everyone is and how careful everyone is, you understand that you're in the right place. So it's very stressful, but very quickly you realize that you know you're in the right place. And for a lot of us, especially for us, it was a hard decision for us to make to put her in the study. And it was early, as Melissa was saying, they were some of the first children that were in the study. It was hard, but we knew there was risk of her going into anaphylactic shock again outside of the hospital, and that we had to take this opportunity to try and make a better life for Tessa and a safer life for Tessa. So.
We'll talk more about when she comes out the other end of it in just a moment. Let's take a quick station break. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing a revolutionary new treatment for children who suffer from life-threatening food allergies. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you or your child suffer from severe food allergies? Have you ever faced a life-threatening situation because of them? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. So just continuing... Kim, coming out on the other side with Tessa, what was it like? There's a New York Times Magazine article that describes going out after she finally was able to take a full dose without any reaction and having pizza and cake and ice cream, which to many families is like the most normal thing in the world. What was going through your mind when that was happening?
Oh, it was incredible. It was such a joyous day. I will never forget the day when we were all in the hospital. My you know, our entire family, the doctors couldn't even get in to the hospital room because all of Tessa's cousins were there, her sisters were there, her grandparents, aunts and uncles. So it was an incredible day. And, you know, she had all these kids really want. It's not really about the pizza and the ice cream and the cupcakes. It's really just being able to have the same experiences that other kids have. I mean, most, you know, we have so many families that Friday night's pizza night or everybody goes down to the local pizza place. And it just was such an amazing feeling for her to be able to go and do that and bump into friends the first time we were out for pizza. And she had a whole group of friends with her that came with us. So it was incredible.
Now, Melissa, Kate was just 5, correct?
Yes.
So what were you able to explain to her going into the first treatments, and what was her reaction and her stress level going into them?
Well, I think because she was 5, she was definitely less aware of the potential risk and what she was doing. She certainly wanted to be like the other children and be able to eat what the other children were eating and just sort of participate like everybody else. So that was what we sort of held out to her as sort of the light at the end of the tunnel. You know, this trial will hopefully deliver these sort of results. And I was clearly nervous. But I had total trust and faith in Dr. Naidoo and her team. The science behind the trial was so compelling that I wasn't as nervous as I thought I would be. By the time we got to the point that the trial was beginning, I was a complete believer, and I was just excited to get going.
Terrific. Kari, I'd like to go back to you now and talk about why has this been done for other types of allergies? It seems like food allergies were somehow treated differently. Is that because they were more dangerous? Or how did earlier research from other allergies affect your work?
It's a great question, because oftentimes a lot of people, when they have allergies to many things, not just foods, but also to things in the environment and animals. 70% of all people will have their allergies start in childhood. About 30% will have it start in adulthood. Many people have more than one allergy to food or environmental. I think we all learned that in studying the science that allergies can happen, and by learning how to treat them, the same methods that we learned how to treat environmental allergies or animal allergies or bee sting allergies can play a role in how we develop food allergy therapy. So it's exactly as you state, that we have used how other people developed what we call allergen immunotherapy, because in the end, you're really changing the immune system in a good way to protect you against having allergies. So allergy immunotherapy has been going on for about 100 years. And for those of you in the audience and for those of you on the phone to know that we have been giving allergy shots for a long time, but that we need to do better about understanding how they work, how long they might be effective for, and how to make sure they're safe. And so we use the same types of questions, importantly, to move forward with food allergy therapy, but you can't give foods as shots. You need to give them in a special way, because foods, especially some of the foods we're talking about today, wheat and milk and egg and nuts, they can be associated with near fatal or fatal allergies, or seafood, for example, or fish. But any food can do it. I've had some patients that have terrible reactions to cinnamon, for example, or other items. So we also have to be humble in that any food can do it, but you wouldn't want to give a food as a shot. Right now, we're thinking about ways to work and change the immune system. And right now, the best way to do that, it looks like, is either through the skin or orally or underneath the tongue. But all of these have to be thought of carefully to offer patients the best, most safe therapy possible for food allergen immunotherapy specifically.
Okay, now let's go to some of our callers. Casey from San Francisco, you're on the air. Welcome to City Visions.
Hello.
Hi, Casey. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Do you have a question for our panel?
I did. I had a question for Dr. Carey. My son has multiple food allergies to wheat, dairy, nuts, eggs, also animals and pollens. But when he was tested to, quote-unquote, that he outgrew the wheat and dairy. He started eating those foods, and he seemed to eat them okay, you know, a little bit of symptoms here and there, nothing life-threatening. However, it also seemed to trigger an autoinflammatory disease that we did not know he had. And we found one mutation for familial Mediterranean fever. When he does not eat the wheat and dairy, he seems to have almost zero symptoms of that. But when he eats it, he gets the autoinflammatory symptoms pretty bad. So my question is, would something like this, Dr. Carey's work, even work on someone like my kid, or is he looking at a different kind of treatment?
Carrie Nadeau from Stanford, do you have a response for our caller?
Sure, and thank you for explaining that. And of course, it's difficult to give any kind of advice for any specific child over the phone.
Sure.
Importantly,
sure.
To speak to a specialist and who is able to examine and take care of your child. But in general, yes, there have been patients with that type of a profile that we have looked at in our clinical trials and we're happy to try to help with. I can't say exactly whether or not it would work, but I can say that, yes, there are examples in which people like that can be helped, and importantly is to feel free to contact us and look at our website and think about ways to move forward, and we're happy to talk to other people that take care of him.
Would you mind giving out the address of your website so that our listeners can get more information if they're interested?
Oh, sure. Thanks so much. So what our website is, for the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy Research, it's med.stanford.edu/forward-allergies.html.
Okay, or just Google the Sean Parker Allergy Research Center, and that will pop up maybe a little bit easier. Let's go to our next caller. Casey, thank you very much for calling in. Ken from San Francisco, welcome to City Visions.
Yeah, hey, interesting topic. I grew up in the 70s, and I don't remember kids having all these allergies, and certainly the very common peanut allergy. I didn't know anyone with it. So was it just not tracked then, or is this some new burgeoning thing that didn't exist back then? I mean, today kids have lice in school. That never occurred to my knowledge. And now they have all these allergies. So I'm interested in finding out if they're actually increased or they were never really properly diagnosed. And the second quick question is, what is the standard for allergy testing? I believe allergy skin testing, where they prick the person's skin, came under some controversy as being pseudoscientific. Can you tell us what the state of the art is or what the standard of care is for testing allergies?
Absolutely. Great question. Those two are actually interlinked, the testing as well as the diagnostics. So unfortunately, our testing is really not any better than where it was almost 20 years ago. And so when you and I were growing up in the 70s, the testing was the same as what we do now. It's basically a combination of skin testing, which is basically putting a steel prick into the food item and then putting that onto your skin and pricking your skin to see if you have a red reaction when you see that item. And unfortunately, that's not a really good test as to whether or not you're going to have clinical reactivity to that food. Because some foods like pineapple and fruits can just be acidic and they can make your skin red and itchy. So unfortunately, skin tests, though, are our best bet so far, and we have not come a long way, and we are trying to develop better tests. There are some blood tests now which are imperfect. They can have false positives and false negatives, which is not good. So that's one of the things we were compelled to do in our allergy center, and with Sean's help, is to be able to get better diagnostics where we can take two drops of blood from a finger prick and be able to know to what degree you're going to have allergies, how severe they're going to be, and whether or not you're going to naturally outgrow them. So these are the things that are right now in progress. We have patents. We're really excited about moving forward in the science, but we have to get better diagnostics. I think it's compelling to be able to get those diagnostics out to the public and have it at as early as a week of life so that we can understand how a child is affected by allergies as well as be able to use it later on at all ages. So the question that you also ask about diagnostics, is this something where we're just getting better at diagnosing so therefore more people have it? What we've looked at, and others, as well as others around the country, is that it's actually not true because our diagnostic tools haven't gotten any better. The rate of food allergies that we're seeing increasing actually seems to be completely real and biological. Now the question that you ask, which is very prudent, is why? Why do we have this doubling every 10 years? Why are peanut allergies on the rise? Why are other allergies on the rise, not just food, but other environmental allergies? And we think it's probably based on both environmental exposures as well as genetics. And we're studying that at Stanford. Other places around the world are studying that too. There seems to be an important interplay with diet, having enough vitamin D and calcium, having a diet that's very healthy with lots of fruits and vegetables and with appropriate amounts of good fats but less sugars plays a role in decreasing your risk of food allergies. Diversifying the diet early on between the ages of 4 to 6 months, where infants and toddlers should be eating a lot of different types of foods, is actually helpful. And we're also studying the role of, like, let's say, probiotics in decreasing people's risk. So we are seeing a rise. We're trying to understand why that is. Many people around the world have also seen a similar rise in other countries, not just the U.S., and so we're trying to get ahead of that. But I think it will be a process in which it's going to take a lot of collaborating by a lot of different scientists to understand the causes and then how to prevent this.
Ken, thank you very much for your call. You are listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing a revolutionary new treatment for children who suffer from life-threatening allergies. We're joined by Dr. Carrie Nato from Stanford University and director of the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy Research, as well as Melissa Kepner and Kim Grosso, two parents whose children have gone through Dr. Nato's clinic. Let's go now back to the phones. We have a lot of interest out there. Alex from San Francisco, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a question for your guest. My son has a food allergy called F5. And oddly enough, he's severely allergic to wheat and anything that contains rice, like the most neutral food products you could ever imagine. And I was wondering, has your guest had any treated any children with this food allergy?
Okay, the allergy of F pies.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for bringing that up. I think that this F pies, or food protein induced enterocolitis syndrome, is something that is rare.
Has your guest applied this type of dual treatment to that type of food allergy before?
Right. We have not. We have to be very careful in our introduction of this experimental therapy to people. We are working hard, as well as others around the country, at trying to find out what causes F-pies. But importantly, is it seems to be different than what causes food allergies, and so it's going to take a different type of therapy. But people are actively working on that, so there is hope and promise there. But right now, I would say to work with your allergist to best help your child.
Okay, Alex, thank you very much for your call. Before we go to some other callers, I want to turn back to Kim and Melissa. And one question I have is, do your daughters have siblings? And if so, how do they react to having a sibling who has a situation like this?
Kate has two siblings, and neither of her siblings have food allergies. And they've actually been incredibly supportive. I think it's been sort of a great family exercise in having children learn empathy and support a child that has a health condition. And in a way, it's been a positive, particularly since we've come out the other side of the tunnel, and Kate can now eat everything she used to be allergic to.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that... I agree. I think it's very hard to teach empathy to children. And I think that Tessa also has two siblings. She has two younger sisters. Neither Reese or Alyssa have food allergies, but they're incredibly sensitive to other kids with food allergies. And we actually we ran our household where no one was allowed to eat anything in the home that Tessa was allergic to. We didn't have anything in the house. Mm-hmm. And Reese and Alyssa actually ate just like Tessa until they were about five. Until they're about 5 years old, and at which point the social issues start to come in, where they're kind of being left out of parties, and
right.
when they were starting to feel the social effects from it, then we felt like it was time to go ahead and you know introduce it into their world, never in the home, but I agree with Melissa. It's they've been incredibly supportive, and it's. I think it was actually a gift. When you're looking for the silver linings in certain things, this
right.
was definitely a silver lining.
Yeah, it has been very heartwarming because not just the siblings, but the friends. I mean, even at a very young age, friends will, you know, caretake my food allergy child and say, you know, worry about an ingredient in a certain food and check for them and choose to set an allergy-free table in the lunchroom. And so it's, you know, these little moments make you smile.
And what is each of their perspective on it now? What is Tessa's lifestyle like now, and how does she think about the fact that she was really a pioneer in doing this research that can help other kids like herself?
I think she had no idea what she was getting, the impact that she would have. I think her life is incredibly different now. She's just a very happy, light kid. And she gets to do the normal things. She gets to go to school and go to sleepovers and go to ice cream and frozen yogurt, you know, walk downtown and do all of the normal things, which is incredibly freeing. And, you know, these kids, they really live life like they're navigating a minefield. And you can't relax in that situation. So you really, the only time we would really get Tessa at her best was when we were home, when she in her safe environment. So it's just, it's really fun. And people that knew her before and know her now, they've just seen this transformation in her. And it's just so fun to see her personality be out all the time.
That's wonderful. And what about Kate?
You know, I'd say Kate's just very proud of herself for going through the trial. It took a lot of, you know, many weeks of going into the hospital setting and getting her up doses. And it was a long road.
At 5 years old, it's remarkable.
At 5 years old, yeah. And so I think she's really proud of herself. I mean, and I think it's a real tangible achievement. I mean, she can eat what she used to have to avoid. And so I think in that regard, you know, she can really sort of taste her success, let's say.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phone line, and a reminder that you can call in to join our conversation at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website, klw.org. Let's now go to a call from Simon in Berkeley. Simon, welcome to City Visions.
Hey, good evening.
Thank you. What is your question for our guests?
It's more of a comment, actually. I'm just wondering what she thinks about the modern agricultural practice of using Roundup to finish a lot of the crops, and also what she thinks about GMOs in the crops. Right now, Roundup is used as a finishing agent so that when the crop gets to a set percentage of moisture content, they basically run the Roundup over the entire field to kill the crop and then harvest it. That means if any of the crop is still green, it uptakes the GMO, uptakes the Roundup into the plant, and then basically it's expressed in the actual seed. Does she have any comment about this, and does she think this might be leading to some of the allergy increases, considering how much of this is used agriculturally as a feedstock for cows and also in the wheat and bread that we eat? I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you for that call, Simon. Dr. Carrie Nadeau from Stanford?
Sure. That's an excellent question. As I was saying, you know, there seems to be a combination of environmental factors as well as genetic factors in people, but importantly are some of the environmental factors that actually might be deleterious to our food allergies. And what we think might be increasing the risk, like you were saying, is perhaps a lot of what's been going on in the fields, pesticides as well as air pollution. We're currently investigating that. Luckily, the National Institutes of Health The NIEHS in particular, as well as the EPA, are funding children's environmental health studies around the country to be able to find out things like this. And so your question is a very good one, as well as for adults. And so we don't have the answers yet, but we are studying that. We need to study it in large numbers, and there are many people around the country looking at this. There does seem to be an effect of certain chemicals in foods that are processed that are having a problem with certain proteins, and those proteins then become allergenic. And so we're trying to understand what those are and the effect of antibiotics in meats, for example, that could possibly increase the risk of allergy. So all these things are being studied, but these are excellent questions, and we just don't have the right answers yet.
Okay, let's now go to Anise in San Francisco. Welcome to City Visions.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I'm an adult, and I have all these allergies to wheat, dairy, sugar, some vegetables, and beans, and I was wondering if they're doing any studies with adults.
Any studies with adults, or is this focus just on children at this point?
Yes, about half of our studies are for adults. We'd also like to make sure that we can help more adults, and we welcome adult participation in our trials. Importantly, is through the start of this new Sean Parker Center for Allergy Research, Sean really wanted to, because he's an adult with near-fatal allergies, that he also wanted to catalyze the discussion around adults that newly have food allergies later in life, as well as adults that have to carry the food allergies they had in childhood forward into adulthood, which can be extremely disabling. And so we will be doing more adult studies this year. So we're excited to help all ages and, importantly, families as well as patients, because this has a ripple effect for all social situations. And we are working with adult patients, and we welcome more.
Thank you for your call. Now let's go to William from Belvedere. William, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much. Actually, the caller before the last raised the issue that I wanted to address, but I'd like to a little further elucidate it. Having to do with the glyphosate component of Roundup that's used so much on Roundup-ready crops, which most people are aware of, genetically modified crops, recent work has shown that it affects the intestinal microbiome because what's known as the shikimate pathway, which is the way in which glyphosate acts to kill weeds, happens to be present in bacteria as well. And certainly, as the doctor guest knows, our intestines are absolutely florid with all kinds of bacteria. And one feeling is that when the shikimate pathway in those bacteria is interfered with, that it affects the ability of our intestine to discern what to absorb and what not to absorb, and that may very well be part of the role of the particularly glyphosate in Roundup. And if the guest had any comments, that would be fine.
Thank you, William. Any comments on that?
Thanks for that. I think there's a lot of potential avenues to look at how different chemicals are affecting our food, but I don't know of any specific examples about Roundup. I apologize.
Now, we also have an email for you, Kari, from Jennifer. She's asking, can you talk about the risks of anti-IgE medication and whether the maintenance regimen subjects them to risks in the future?
Those are all great questions. We always want to minimize risks and maximize effect. We want to help people long-term, and we don't want to have people need medications for longer than they need them. And especially for children, we have to be extremely careful for benefits and risks. So luckily, with Xolair, with this omalizumab drug, we had a lot of safety data that had already been accumulated because it was being used in asthma. And it was in asthma patients, actually, it's used every month or every 2 weeks for the rest of these patients' lives. So we almost had 20 years of cumulative data for safety on these patients. And there are black box warnings that one has to be careful of, that we proceeded
very diligently with the Food and Drug Administration around those, as well as our Institution Review Board. But right now, we have not seen any major side effects or minor side effects due to the Xolair dosing. It can create some irritation around when it's given as a shot, but we have not had any experience of anything that would have permanent side effects.
You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing life-threatening food allergies. Our guests are Dr. Kari Nato from Stanford University, as well as Melissa Kepner and Kim Grosso, two parents who have had their children in Kari's clinic. You can join our conversation by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website at klw.org. I want to talk some about this new Sean N. Parker Allergy Research Center. Before we get there, my understanding is funding was very tight when you were first getting started, Kari. In fact, that you actually went without a salary for this work for a number of years. Why was it so hard to get funding at the beginning, number one? And put in perspective how big this $24 million is in terms of moving forward and trying to help more people.
Yeah, we are so thrilled and excited, and I'm sure Kim and Melissa can comment because they went through the difficult times. And like anything, it takes a lot of sacrifice and sweat and tears to work through this. But with perseverance, with tenacity, and with people that believe in you like Kim and like Melissa, it was easy for me to make sure that I was inspired by their children and just kept going because I felt very passionate about it. And I think that's true in many new discoveries and innovation, that you have to stick your nose to the ground, keep focused, and really make sure that you want to make an impact in this world. And I'm so grateful now that we're out of the difficult times and that people like Sean Parker can see what we've done, and then if past is prologue, they can invest in us through philanthropy to help us. And so this amount of money, the $24 million, is also in aggregate part of a larger sum of money that around the world, this is the biggest donation ever in the area of allergy. And so I think this also plants a flag that now we're compelled to be accountable and responsible to give that hope and promise and to lead globally in terms of making new discoveries in the causes and the cures for allergy. But importantly is it also plants a flag for seeds and collaboration, and that we want to at Stanford make sure that any discoveries that we made are shared immediately to the public, shared immediately with other collaborators so they can be tested outside of Stanford and Lucile Packard. But importantly is that these monies will help create a network alliance of sites throughout the globe to be able to test our protocols and work together and share data so that we can better make research highly impactful to people. And that's what's exciting for me, is that this money just doesn't stay in one place, that we are able to mobilize it to help others throughout the globe. And those times that I look back on in the past, they are the past, but I'm so appreciative of all the people that invested in us back 9 years ago, 8 years ago, and they saw that this was coming. So I'm really excited that now we are here and we ought to move forward.
And can you talk about where you are in the trial process right now, where you've been, where you are now, and how quickly you'll be moving forward to the next phases?
Yeah, so again, it's through collaboration. We are doing what I like to call first two science. We need to make sure we're pushing the envelope and always have about five phase one trials going forward that are trying new therapies to be able to push the envelope safely and effectively to look at new ways to treat people with food allergies or near-fatal allergies. And that's going to take understanding the immune system better, and that's where Sean Parker and I have been looking at ways to work effectively with the immune system. So that's about any time that we're looking forward in the future. We're always going to try to do some new trials and make sure that the FDA is okay with that, but that's got to be done in adults first. In addition, we have another set of trials that are what we call phase two trials, in which we're testing some therapies that we've already found to be safe, but now we need to move forward and see if they're efficacious. And that's phase two. We're really excited to work with the NIH and another organization called the Immune Tolerance Network so that we can really find out if what we did in the first phase now works in the next phase. And that's a process that the FDA puts forward to any medical regimen that in the end we want to make sure gets out to the public and gets covered by insurance. So we have a plan and we're progressing on that plan so that we can try if everything works and it's significant that we can then help get this covered by insurance to be able to have this to people throughout the world as a therapy that's offered to them.
Okay, thank you. And let's go back to our phones. We have Ileana from Oakland. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. I have a question about whether the center that the doctor works for does treat any adults who have mastocytosis or some mast cell disorder, other than the systemic form.
Carrie Nato from Stanford, yes. Can you respond to Ileana?
Sure. So thanks for asking that. We do take care of patients with mast cell disorders and mastocytosis. Those are seen in our outpatient clinics at Stanford University Hospitals and Lucile Packard. So if you're interested, you can also go on our website, and there are many allergists that specialize in that at Stanford, and they can see you as part of our medical care system.
And again, we encourage our listeners, probably the easiest thing is just to Google the Sean Parker Allergy Research Center to get to that website and get more information. Let's now go to Gabe in San Francisco. Gabe, welcome to City Visions this evening.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. My question pertains to cold urticaria. Roughly around high school, I noticed I started to develop a severe reaction to cold weather and even holding a cold soft drink. Around the age of 18, I noticed that my hands would start to swell up, and my condition really didn't become too much of a problem until I actually went to graduate school in UCSF for pharmacy, and I noticed that every time I would come to class, I would actually become like a tomato. And I was wondering if some of your treatments were possibly relevant to my condition.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. So the question is about a disease called cold-induced urticaria. We do see this in patients. It's very rare as an allergist, but important. And I would say right now the therapy that we're using for food isn't necessarily perfect for that type of disorder, but importantly is to work with your allergist. There are people in the globe, not myself, but there are people around that are working on that. They will be associated with our center. And if you email our center, there's an inquiry email, and if you're interested, we can update you with our newsletter as any findings we have in the field of cold urticaria, because we are actively researching that, and I think that's what we're bringing the best minds together to be able to help in all allergic disorders, including cold urticaria, including FPIs, including eosinophilic esophagitis and some of these other rare disorders, as well as asthma and eczema and allergic rhinitis or hay fever.
Gabe, thank you very much for your call. We have a final email from Sarah in Denver who wants to know when these treatments will be available in clinics throughout the country.
Okay, Sarah, thank you so much. We're working on that. We're very thankful for a gift from the Bezos Foundation, in which that's exactly what Jeff Bezos and his wife Mackenzie asked me, as when can this be out for the public? And we've been working with the FDA to be able and the NIH to develop phase two trials to try to look at the recipe that we're using now that's been helpful in both Melissa's child and Kim's child, for example, and getting that out to be tested. And once it meets certain criteria, we want to make sure that it can get approved by insurance companies. And that will hopefully take another 2 to 3 years. And there are other companies now working around the world. One is called the Allergen Research Corporation. Another is called DVS, in which they're making a patch on the skin. So I think what's so exciting is that
not only our center, but also other companies around the world are working together to be able to formulate different ways of therapy so that as a patient, you will have options. And I think that's the most important thing, is when you come to the table, it's really great to have options that work for you and your schedule and that are safe and effective.
Sarah, we appreciate that email from Denver, Colorado. And Kari, are these children considered cured or just desensitized to the allergy?
Excellent question. So we never use the word cure. We want to be extremely humble. This is the immune system that we're working with. It takes a long time to try to treat someone, and we need to follow people for a long time to know whether or not they're going to be quote-unquote cured. And cured, in my mind, means that they can eat whatever they want, whenever they want, and not worry about that. Many people perceive, though, that they're cured and that they can eat the food every day without having a reaction, and that's what people are feeling right now. And our longest patient out is about 9 years now, and we're finding that people are able to eat ad lib, but I don't want to use the word cure. I want to be really careful as a physician, do the right science to make sure that this is going to last a lifetime. But from the perspective of the patient, it would seem that they are very excited about the results. So that's what makes me happy as well, so that I can continue to follow them and make sure this is sticking.
Thank you. And we just have a few minutes left. I want to come back to you, Kim and Melissa. And I was wondering if you each could just, for the parents out there who are listening who have children with severe allergies, what advice would each of you give them, given what you each have gone through? Melissa Kepner.
Well, first of all, I would just want to share with them that there's a lot of hope out there. I mean, there's just the promising research that Dr. Nadeau is doing right now is going to bring us the next phase of treatment for our children. And so, you know, don't feel alone and feel scared by your child's prognosis. There's a lot of progress being made out there. And so that would be the number one thing I would do. And then I would just look into, is there any available treatment in your area? Dr. Nadeau's research has some satellites, and I'll let her speak to that, but it's in about 4 or 5 other cities. So you can become a trial patient in some other locations outside of the Bay Area. So I would encourage you to see if your child is eligible and participate in one of these trials, because it really is life-changing to receive this treatment.
Kim, the last word from you.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure.
You've been under so much more pressure than one radio program.
I would agree that I think the biggest thing is that there is hope. And, you know, it was a lot of people had told me when the New York Times article came out that was the first time most people ever really felt hope. So I really think I agree with Melissa, is that keep seeking out any type of help and go to your doctor. And Kari is an incredibly collaborative doctor, and she is not trying to keep this treatment here in California. And I've seen what dedicated parents can do and seen what's happened here. And I encourage other families to get involved and make it happen in their areas as well.
Well, thank you all very much for joining me this evening. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests this evening were Dr. Kari Nadeau from Stanford, Melissa Kepner and Kim Grasso, parents of children who have participated in Dr. Nadeau's allergy trials. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. Join my co-host, Joseph Pace, next Monday for a conversation about the San Francisco tech boom and the Tenderloin. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.